session number 9706, reel 1.
Mr. Lawrence, reel 1. Now, Mr. Lawrence, you were captured by the Japanese in March 1942 in Java. Can you tell me what the circumstances of your capture were?
Well, when... I must go back to the time of the fall of Singapore. Just before the fall of Singapore, certain members of the Royal Air Force were sent off to Australia and India, and the only members of the RAF who were kept were those considered to be of importance to keep things going. So we were moved from Singapore to Sumatra, and eventually the Japanese were capturing Sumatra, so we went on to Java.
When you say we, this is your unit.
That is my unit, yes. The squadron, 36th Squadron, the squadron I was with. Then we reach March 1942, and it was obvious that the Japanese were going to conquer the island as they had the other islands. The Dutch army moved out as far as possible. What Americans were there moved out. We were left behind. In actuality, I have since found out there were roughly 600 Royal Air Force fellows left behind in Java. And on March the 8th, we were liaisoned to the Dutch army to obey their instructions. And on March the 8th, the Dutch capitulated to the Japanese, so therefore came our capitulation too.
Can you tell me a little bit about your squadron, about its nature, the type of planes you were flying, that they were flying, and so on?
I can summarise it best that when I left England to go out to Singapore in 1941, and arrived at Salita, I joined number 36 Torpedo Squadron, which of course has been entirely wiped out. And when I first saw these biplanes, I said to our commanding officer, this is so astonishing to me to see these things. Do they fly? And my commanding officer looked rather hurt and said, of course they fly, Lawrence. Of course they do. They would have done justice to perhaps the First World War.
What kind of planes were they?
They were Wildebeest. They were inertia starters. Therefore, it meant that to get them to start, you stood on the wing with a handle, put it into the side like you did in like you would with the old-fashioned motor car, wind it at which the thing on an inertia started, made the usual noise, and when it reached a certain pitch, your pilot shouted, contact, contact, and you pulled the handle out and he pressed the switch and up went the engine. It used to be great fun before the actual Japanese war broke for the pilot to take off straight away before you could almost get in at the back. Therefore, you tumbled in head first and hoped for the best, leaving the pilot grinning all over his face that that's the way you got in your plane. Their speed... Well, I think most motor cars on the continental highways go faster than those planes went. And do remember that this was supposed to be the mighty fortress of Singapore. And that is about all we had to defend it.
You say they were practically wiped out. Can you explain the circumstances under which they were wiped out?
Well, we were up against the Japanese Navy O planes, which just danced circles around us. The Australians did, after the Japanese war started, send out some bow fighters, which were quite hopeless. We had a few Hurricanes, which had not been calibrated with their engines to suit the tropical climate. And speaking technically, you need, in a normal way, in a Hurricane fighter, a boost reading to start off with, a boost of about figure 8. The highest boost reading you could get on a Hurricane in the tropics was half that. It meant to say that there was no guts in your engine before you ever started. Nobody ever thought, when they sent out the Hurricanes, that they needed recalibrating for the tropical climate and not for a normal temporal climate. Every one of them were wiped out by Navy O's because they danced circles around us. And one by one, we lost our wildebeest and the men in them. We ended up, when the war finished, we ended up with about 3 wildebeest planes, and we were filling the tyres with grass and straw to keep those planes going. And eventually, we had no more torpedoes to put on them anyway, so that was the end of it.
What was morale like in the squadron when they were suffering these losses?
To me, to try and be unprejudiced, amongst the British chaps, we kept up a pretty high morale. There was always the wag. There was always the one that made jokes that kept the spirits up generally. But I cannot say that, unfortunately, of the morale of the Dutch. They were easily despondent. But that is nothing against the Dutch, because I only have admiration for the way the army fought out there. That is the Indonesian, the Dutch Indonesian. Is to distinguish between the white Dutch, whom you called Hollanders, and the native Dutch, who you called Javanese, or you called them Dutch. But a white man was called a Hollander.
What was your own personal role in the squadron?
I was actually entered on my pay book as an instrument engineer. And that ostensibly was what I went out supposed to be doing. But by everything being in the chaos that it was, and being so few of us, we all ended up by doing anything we were called upon to do. A good example of that, at the very last, was having been reduced in numbers by the fact of the Japanese dropping bombs, and so we were killed on the ground, and the loss of our various personnel in the flying, we had just 3 torpedoes left. And the commanding officer at the time turned to me and said to me, Lawrence, this is one of the last trips. There's the Japanese fleet out there. Have a go. To which, actually, I replied, sir, I have not been trained to drop torpedoes. To which he then returned the fact by saying, I can't make you go. But he had a smile on his face. He said, but you won't refuse to go, will you? And I said, no, sir. When I think back on it, I don't think it was heroics. I was never a hero. There was nothing brave about it. It was just the fact that I thought, well, I'm going to die anyway. I might as well die this way.
Can you describe that sortie?
Yes. We took off from our makeshift drone, having been pointed where we were attacked to attack a Japanese ship. We came down and to the level at which we you had to be to drop a torpedo, and we had everything thrown at us by the Japanese guns. I was so terrified and so absolutely frightened and in such a state that, and so was my pilot, that when it came to the time, I wished I'd never ever said I would go. The pilot was screaming at me, do remember, this is open cockpit, and he was screaming at me, let it go, let it go. But do you know that when I look back on it, my stupidity, please don't look upon it as heroism, it was not. I was so schooled in the factor that we had to flatten out and go straight to drop that torpedo, that I'm still insisting that he kept a level course in spite of everything coming at us. When I look back on it, I look back in horror. Eventually I dropped the torpedo and he screamed away, swung to starboard, and how he got away I do not know. But I'm quite sure my torpedo blew a hole in the ocean bed. It certainly didn't do anything to the Japanese ship.
How do you know that?
Well, the way it was dropped. Anybody who... See, it's not the days of Exocet where you dropped a torpedo from 20 miles away. You had to really go right almost to your ship, dead level. And when you dropped your torpedo, you had to actually watch it drop your fish. We called them fish. You had to drop it flat and almost watch it take its course. Well, I dropped that torpedo and I'm quite sure that it went down and not along the water. So I certainly never saw any explosion, even when I looked back. So I probably made a hole in the ocean bed. I can in no way say other than I felt sick and terrified at the whole episode. But we got back. There was no heroism in it, I assure you.
Was the plane full of holes?
Oh, yes, we were shot to pieces. You see, the wings, of course, are sailcloth. You see, they were the old doped sailcloth, I mean, and they were ripped to pieces. We were in ribbons, yet neither of us were touched.
Nothing vital had been hurt.
Well, we made rather a bad landing. That was a write-off for that plane. I expect, in actuality, that we'd had most of our ailerons shot away. That was the end of that plane.
How many sorties did you fly against the Japanese fleet?
That was the only one that I actually, that was the last one that I actually flew against the Japanese at the time. But the squadron itself flew quite a few. I wouldn't like to know how many, until there was no more left of us.
What kind of appearance did the Japanese fleet present?
Formidable. Formidable. I could go back to saying that I was in right at the very start of the Japanese war. I was up at Kota Baru where they first attacked, which was on the border of Siam, or Thailand as it's known now. And I was there at the very, very start when they attacked. And when they landed, they came off of those ships in swarms. There was no way of keeping them back. The more you shot at them, our plane, what few planes we had, took off. Their pilots took them off alone to get them away. And we were left behind to make our way as best we could. Well, there was only one thing to do. As a matter of fact, we joined up with the Indian Army. And I became an infantry man in my own particular way. But the more you shot the Japanese, you found them coming in swarms, climbing over their own comrades' dead bodies. There was no way of stopping them.
Can you tell me how you first received the news of the Japanese landing? Can you recollect it?
Oh, yes. Yes. Just in early December... the very beginning of December, because the war broke out, the Japanese war broke out on December the 8th. At the very beginning of December, part of my squadron was sent, including myself, was sent up to Kota Buru, which was on the border of Thailand, and it was the northernmost part of Malaya. And we were doing manoeuvres, you know, exercises. And I had been, this particular night, I'd been working a little late down on the drone with what planes we had. With us was the Australian 1st Squadron. A few planes that they had. I went to have a shower, and it was early hours of the morning. I came back from the shower. Most of the fellows were asleep in our wooden huts. I had just a towel around me. I came back into the hut, and all at once I heard tremendous explosions, bombs going off, everything. I wondered what on earth was happening, and on came the tannoy system. Pay attention. Pay attention. All station personnel, take action, war stations, immediately. So we were at war with Japan. And I had the unusual experience of being right on the front line for that particular war. Next thing I realised, there were planes flying over from the aircraft, Japanese aircraft carriers, strafing us. I fell flat on my face onto my bed, and I can to this very day hear the bullets ripping the wood to pieces of the hut, and hear the wood splintering as they flew over strafing. I got dressed. Dressed means you put on a pair of shorts and a shirt. And I well remember dashing down to the drome to see what we could do. So in actuality, what happened was the armourers were putting torpedoes onto our planes. The Australians were putting bombs on theirs. All they did was took off, made a circle, and they were over the sea. So you could actually see them making their circle, drop in their bombs, or drop in their torpedoes on the Japanese, and then coming back and landing and reloading again and going off and doing this until there was nothing left of them.
Could you see whether they were having any success?
The success was practically nil. It was such chaos, such absolute, well, mayhem. We were not only being strafed, torpedoed, shelled, we were being shelled as well from this. And they had very little chance of doing anything because the opposition was so tremendous. The flak going up from all these ships didn't give you a chance. I must pay admiration to the Australian squadron because they took the brunt of it and... they were heroic. They just allowed themselves eventually to be shot out of the sky.
So none of the aircrew actually refused to go up?
Nobody refused to go up. You just did what you had to do. Eventually there was nothing else to do. They were landing on which was the edge of the drone, really, the landing, because you were right, but the drone was right by the sea. And as they were landing, well, what planes that were still able to take off took off and flew away. We had a few planes left, and the pilots took them alone, took off and left us. So it was a case of sheer unadulterated chaos. I went back to the hut during this goings on. when our planes had gone and there was nothing else and nobody to tell us what we should do or what we shouldn't do. And I thought to myself, well, I have a water bottle. I must fill it with water because it looks to me as if we're going to end up by having to escape through the jungle. There's no doubt about that. I filled the water bottle, but I had no carrier for it. The result is that I fixed my water bottle to the belt that I had around me, full of water, and kept that with me. It was a bit uncomfortable. It stuck out at an angle as a result. And went back to see what I could join in. Well, there was only one thing to do, really and truly. We needed... There's a terrible desire under such circumstances to be together with people and not to be alone. And the other thing is somebody who is masterful enough to take command and say, do this or do that. And the only people to turn to was the officers of the Indian Army that were there. That was all we had.
Did they give any leadership?
Well, I went to one of the Indian officers myself and I said to him, we are alone now. Our men have gone. What few planes we've got have gone. We have no officers to turn to. May I join with you and with your army unit and be with you? To which he replied at the time, Sahib, I cannot give you orders. I said, you bloody well will give me orders. He said, in which case, he said, you are used to a machine gun. I said, yes, because GO, he said, that is what we're using. He said, then here's a present of one. Stand with us to fight. Which I did.
Where did you fight?
In ditches as they approached onto the shores. I was along with my comrades. We just fired at them and fired at them. It didn't stop them. What I think is a tremendous psychological interest here is the fact that daylight broke. There was a lull. They were still shelling us. There was a lull from movement by the Japanese. Eventually we realised and the order came, move back, and that was through the jungle.
From the beach were you attempting to stop?
From about here to the sea here, but that's no distance. How far are we?
Quarter
of a mile, yes. That would be about it, I suppose. Well, we had to move back. Am I right? We had to move back. We had the orders to move back. I jumped up from my ditch and ran.
But were you actually hitting them with a machine gun?
We were. We were absolutely... The Indian Army was superb. We were actually mowing those Japanese down, and they still landed and came in swarms. Where there were dead bodies, they climbed over them, and they still went on coming. It was like trying to keep back a swarm of ants.
How many do you think you hit?
I have no idea. Hundreds I must have done. Myself personally must have done. Apart from, it was like, well, I do know that one of my comrades at one particular stage told me that we had the river running, and there was the mouth of the river running to one side, and he was on that side, and he said he waited. The Indian officer told them to wait, watching the Japanese coming up in boats. And when they opened fire on them, and he said, well, the whole river turned red with all the blood. But it didn't stop the Japanese coming.
Did you have enough ammunition?
No, we were running right out of ammunition. And there was only one thing to do, and that was to move back. So we did. The psychological fact that I was going to mention was that jumping out of this ditch to run and move back, I suddenly, well, of course you're absolutely running with perspiration and fear. I was no hero at all. Fear the whole time, dreadful fear. Pouring with perspiration, running, and I suddenly felt a terrific jerky movement and a wetness down my left side, so I fell flat on my face, allowing the bullets to go over my head. I had a sort of a temporary sort of blackout for a moment, and with my eyes hard closed, I could feel all one side of myself wet. And I thought, there's no doubt about it, the whole of my side has been shot away.
Were you in pain?
I was in no pain, but a whole of my side, I came to the conclusion, the whole of my side was shot away. I was wet. I very, very slowly put my hand down to my side, still with my eyes closed, thinking, this is it. I cannot get up. I am absolutely, in a sense, paralyzed. Slowly I brought my hand up in front of my eyes and opened them. And when I looked at my hand, it was water. And the moment my brain realized it was water, I was up like a shot. But until that moment, I could not have moved. I realized what had happened. And when I did get into the jungle and I looked at my water bottle, it was peppered like a colander.
What were they firing at you with? Automatic weapons?
Oh, yes. Yet not one bullet hit me. This is a consistent and persistent story right the way through with my life, right to the factor, to the end, where even in Nagasaki.
So all the your superior officers of the RAF had been wiped out, had they?
Or had gone. Or had gone. I'm not saying anything more than that. Or had gone.
Did you discover whether any of them had in fact fled?
Well, this has always been a touchy subject for me, because I don't exactly like to put on record. I have discussed it in various times over the years with various people of very high position. After all, I had many a long and interesting social chat with General Percival, who after all signed me, and talking to him personally on this subject, he looked at me and said to me, I take it, Lawrence, that this is something. I said, it's the truth, General Percival. I said, it's all right. In a sense, I almost, without saying it, I wouldn't talk about it. I don't wish to talk about it now. Same thing happened with the meeting with Brigadier Tuzi, who was a dear man. He since is dead. And also various high-ranking officers of the Royal Air Force, but I don't like to talk about certain behaviour.
So you disappeared into the jungle then?
Yes. We eventually made our way, some of them, what was left of us, the best way we could. Again, an interesting note. Whilst traipsing through that jungle to try and get out somewhere onto a road and get as far, move south as fast as we could, of course, we were without water. But we had learned a certain amount of jungle lore. By lore, I mean L-O-R-E, not L-A-W. And one of the things that you want water is to, you'd have bamboo trees. And if you can hack bamboo at a certain spot where there are notches, rainwater collects in the sections. So if you can hack a long stem of bamboo in the right spot, and then make a hole in the section, you'll find that you are drinking pure rainwater. And that, of course, was a...